It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomchik, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
No job today.
No job today. He was a little bit late coming back on a vacation trip that he took, so it's just me this time.
All right. Well, luckily you've got plenty with you. I see by the large stack of papers and notes. So let's get into that.
Okay.
Governor Gary Locke, our education governor. apparently he's learned a lesson and he's not going to do anything in terms of education.
Well, he has largely given up on funding education. He's looking at a 1% sales tax increase as his plan to put more money towards education. This is after declaring that he was going to be the education governor who would help fund major improvements in our state's schools. Now, it's worth noting that that 1% sales tax increase is a regressive tax. That's as opposed to a progressive tax that might ask people to pay more if they're able to pay more. That's asking the rich to pay more and not expecting the poor to cover the bulk of the money for state schools. Now, the sales tax is a regressive tax in that it's mostly poor people who pay it. And since Tim Iman's initiative for repealing the car tab taxes and letting everybody pay $30 regardless of what kind of vehicle they drive, pretty much got rid of a progressive tax, one that was based on the assessed value of your car. If you could afford to buy a bigger car or a more expensive car, you had to pay more tax. That's a progressive tax. Now, everybody pays $30, and that cut quite a bit of money out of the state budget. Gary Locke has had to fall back on a 1% sales tax increase after trying to get the legislature to fund education in a more progressive way. For example, increasing property taxes, which, although people hate to pay them, are a progressive tax, because if you can afford a bigger house or you can afford to buy more property, usually you can afford to pay more tax. Now, I should also mention too that Tim Iman has an initiative. What is it, 864?
Yeah,
that's coming up. That's gonna tackle the property tax, another progressive tax. So I'm urging people to not sign the initiative and not vote for it.
I'm wondering on his Locke's dispersal of education dollars, where that would actually be going. I'm kind of curious because you tend to think that the rich would be getting using more higher education and therefore accessing more of that money that would be available. But as opposed to the poor that don't go as far, you know, they tend to,
right.
I mean, it's a stereotype, but they tend to, you know, don't go as far in college because they don't have the means to.
Yeah.
So.
Well, right now it is largely tuition rates have gone up by double digits in the last year or two and are set to go up again. So it is becoming only wealthier people who can afford to send their kids to school. Now, Governor Locke signed into law this last week a bill that gives tax breaks to high-tech companies for research and development. Now, Locke, having given up on funding education and being the education governor, has turned to being the corporate tax break governor. His big plan this year, the one that he drew up and submitted to the legislature and told them that they had to get done, was this tax break for research and development for high-tech companies. Now, it's been billed as something that's supposed to help small startup companies, but I should point out that the lobbyists who really worked the hardest for this and who helped Governor Gary Locke draft his plan are folks from Microsoft and Amgen, which is the largest biotech company in the world. Folks might remember that Immunex had acquired some land on the waterfront and managed to get the city and the state to help them build a special freeway or special highway overpass to service only Immunex employees so that they didn't have to stop and wait for trains to pass so that they could get to their waterfront property. Now, Immunex was bought out by Amgen, so now Amgen, the largest biotech company in the world, has already benefited from the city and the state having built them a special overpass for their new little headquarters here on the Seattle waterfront, those guys have been heavily lobbying the state legislature for this R&D tax credit. And, of course, they know, as many of the people who I'm sure voted for this bill in, you know, many of the Republicans who voted for this bill at the state level know that this is really going to benefit Microsoft and Amgen much more than it's going to benefit these little startup companies.
That was Immunix and Amgen that had started building those expensive, like, six buildings and then, like, stopped partway through and only completed, like, three or four of them.
Right. It changed after Amgen bought Immunix. They decided they didn't need quite as much space there. However, they are still getting the benefits of the little waterfront park there that is largely inaccessible to the public. It'll only be used mostly by Amgen employees.
All right, so that was a good investment.
So Governor Locke, our education governor, really is our corporate tax break governor, especially after that enormous deal for Boeing, that enormous giveaway package for Boeing, and now this.
Right, where the details continue to come out with, you know, just how far back the state bent over to give Boeing extra little perks here and there beyond that $3.2 billion.
Right, and that Martha Choi, who was basically responsible for putting together the Boeing package, she was working for the state, she was working for Gary Locke, she put together this wonderful, enormous billions of dollars of tax breaks for Boeing. She has now been hired by the state to just serve Boeing only in helping them set up their little recruitment and training center for new employees for their new plant, 77 plant. So basically, she's a state-paid employee of Boeing.
All right. Well, that sounds like more money well spent. It just keeps racking up. Well, maybe Gary Locke is making these decisions because he ate some bad beef. Some mad cow tainted beef. And
yes, he was one of those people who stood up right after the cow was found in Yakima with mad cow disease at the slaughterhouse in Yakima. He's the one who stood up and said, "Beef is safe," you know, an unqualified endorsement, and you know, chowed down on some hamburger right there for everybody to see. So I wouldn't be surprised. Now, there have been some startling new discoveries in the whole mad cow. On the whole mad cow scene. The worst one, I think, is that Italian scientists at the University of Verona discovered a new strain of mad cow disease in two cows that they tested. They call it BASE, and I'm going to try to pronounce it here. It's bovine amyloidotic spongiform encephalopathy. And they named it that because instead of just eating holes in your brain, in the brains of these cows, this form of a bovine spongiform encephalopathy also leaves behind little amyloid plaques. They look kind of like little calcium deposits, little amyloid plaques in the brain. And it also strikes older cows. Now, the interesting thing about this is that there is a form of sporadic Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, CJD, which is the human form of encephalopathy. There's a form of that strikes a certain number of Americans every year, particularly older people, that doctors have always said is sporadic. It just arises on its own. It just happens spontaneously. Now, that form of CJD also leaves little amyloid plaques, and it also strikes older people. So the correspondence between this new form of BSE and the sporadic form of human Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease are very, very close, and it's very possible that these so-called sporadic or spontaneous cases of human CJD could be caused by this new strain of bovine spongiform encephalopathy that we don't have a test for and that the USDA is not testing for. Now, there's was another kind of interesting development this week, too. The House Committee in Congress took testimony from three people who said that the cow that was slaughtered in Yakima that tested positive for mad cow disease was not a downer cow. She was actually walking when she got on the truck, according to the cattle hauler. She was walking at the slaughterhouse, according to the slaughterhouse employee who killed her. And the owner of the slaughterhouse plant says that he does not accept downer cows and that he has a contract with both the hauler and with the farmers who send him cows for slaughter to not send him downer cows. And he says that the USDA has actually lied about this to the public. and that he has been trying for the last several weeks to get this all straightened out with the USDA, and they have not responded to any of his letters or phone calls or anything. Now, Vern's Meats, which is the name of the slaughterhouse, began doing a blanket testing. The only reason this cow was caught was because they do blanket testing at his facility. It's a very small slaughterhouse, but he tests every animal that comes in the door, whether it's healthy or whether there's some question of whether it might or might not be a downer cow. Now, he began the blanket testing in October. Since then, they've taken about 258 samples through the end of the year of cattle brain tissue that were sent to be tested. And among those, they found the one cow who had BSE. Now, that's a very small sample, but it's a comprehensive sample. They tested every animal that came in the door. So now that raises the question, what would happen if you tested every animal that went to slaughter in the United States, some 35 million cows, instead of 20,000 cows, which are what were tested last year? That's about the USDA, since they only test about 20,000, and they're saying they want to, like, double that number. 20,000 is only about 0.06% of the total cows that are slaughtered. That's 0.06%, an infinitesimally small number of animals being tested. Doubling that would still be an infinitesimally small sample. Now, if they tested more than that, they might come up with many, many, many more cases of BSE, particularly among healthy animals that can still walk. Now, the USDA is saying, well, if you force us to test more animals, why don't we just go with those animals that are over 30 months of age, since those are the animals that are most likely to have the disease? However, it's worth noting that in the UK in the 1990s, when they tested cattle, they tested all cattle to try to find out which ones had BSE. They came up with 84 cattle under the age of 30 months that tested positive for the disease. In Japan, where they've been testing every cow since they found their first case, they have come up with animals as young as 21 months to 23 months that have tested positive for the disease. So, excuse me. So given that only 15% of the animals that are slaughtered are over 30 months of age, most of them are under 30 months of age, I think that's a good argument for testing each and every single animal that goes to a slaughterhouse in the U.S.
And as this guy has demonstrated, it sounds like he has a smaller operation if he did 250. Mm-hmm. Then it's not an economic issue. You know, it's not an economic impact.
Oh, it is not at all. Japan does it, and it has not economically impacted their importation and their sale of meat. It hasn't affected their slaughterhouses or their farmers. It would add a few cents a pound to the price of hamburger. Hamburger is enormously cheap for what you get. And it's not at all an economic issue, in spite of what the USDA says and in spite of what some industry officials claim. And it would also be much, much easier than they say. They say, oh, it takes weeks to test and get the results back. Well, that's because we're using an outdated test. If we used the kind of tests that they have in Japan and in Europe, we could get the results of the test back much more quickly.
All right. Anything else on that?
Yeah, I just want to point out, too, that it's really easy for people right now to be exposed to the kinds of cattle tissue that carry the disease. Now, we know that slaughterhouse practices in the U.S. utilize a machine called the Advanced Meat Recovery Machine that scrapes flesh off of the spinal cord, and that machine often collects spinal cord tissue. And the result is that you get this meat paste from the scrapings off the spinal cord that includes spinal cord tissue, and that meat paste is used in things like taco filling, pizza toppings, hot dogs, lunch meat, sausages, beef jerky, all kinds of things that you eat, that you might eat every day, and more importantly, things that your children eat. Kids love hot dogs, and they love pizza toppings, and they love tacos, etc. So it's very important for us to be looking at this and saying, is this a good practice or not? Well, I would say it's obviously not a good practice. Now, cattle brains from animals under 30 months of age are allowed to be removed and boiled down and used in things like beef flavoring, beef broth, and also things like things where you just have the beef flavoring. You don't have the actual beef itself in there. Nutritional supplements like certain glandular extracts and things that people might go to the health store and buy in order to help them, you know, bulk up and become healthy. Sometimes those things contain cattle brains. Now, those are things that should be banned. That's a process that should be banned, particularly since we know that mad cow disease, the prions that are responsible for mad cow disease, are not broken down by the rendering process, and heat does not destroy them. Then they should stop putting cattle brains and spinal cord tissue and so forth in these products.
Meat paste.
Good argument for going vegetarian if you're ever going to decide to do it.
Now's a good time to take that leap. All right. Perhaps we can move on to the international scene and this week in Iraq.
I will start with the toll this week in Iraq. Guerrillas raided the main police station in Fallujah last Saturday, killing some 23 police and wounding 35 other people, most of them Iraqi police. They also freed about 87 prisoners. The guerrillas hit the police station with mortars, heavy machine gun fire, and the police themselves only had a few Kalashnikovs in order to fight back. They quickly ran out of ammunition. In addition, the Iraqi police had no radios at all in order to call for backup, and the phone lines to the building had been cut. The police were so poorly equipped that many of them were unarmed when they were attacked. Now, U.S. newspapers and media outlets immediately reported that the attackers were foreigners and probably linked to Al-Qaeda, quoting anonymous U.S. military officials. And in fact, I saw it mentioned twice in a New York Times article that they were probably Al-Qaeda. However, 2 days later, U.S. military officials, a man named General Mark Kimmett, as well as the head of the Fallujah Police Department, came out and said that the attackers appeared to be local Iraqis. One of the four dead attackers was a former member of the Iraqi military, and while they were under attack, many of the Iraqi police had actually recognized some of the men who were attacking them. Now, the day after the attack, the surviving Iraqi police had to go on patrol. Most of them went on patrol with their faces covered because they were afraid of reprisals. The Iraqi police complained that the guerrillas were much better trained than they were, and they drove their cars right up to the concrete barricades and then used the barricades for cover while they fired on the police station. Two other buildings were attacked simultaneously in Fallujah, the Civil Defense Corps building, which is where the paramilitary troops are based, and the mayor's office, so that also prevented any backup from arriving to help them. Also on that day, on Saturday, an American missionary was killed in a drive-by shooting. On Monday, three U.S. troops died in separate roadside bomb attacks in Baghdad, Bakuba, and Tal Afar. On Wednesday, two trucks packed with explosives blew up outside the Polish-run base in Hilla. 11 Iraqi civilians died in that attack, and more than 100 people were wounded, including many women and children, and about 58 soldiers at the base. Four homes near the base were completely destroyed. Almost 300 people have died from suicide bombings just since the first of this year, and most of those have been civilians. Also on Wednesday, a mortar fired from a U.S. Army base in Tikrit went astray and landed in a residential neighborhood, destroying a house, killing the couple inside and their 10-year-old child. On Wednesday night, guerrillas fired more than 30 mortar rounds and 5 rockets at the Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad. On Thursday, yet another roadside bomb, this time in Khalidiyah, killed 2 more U.S. soldiers. On Friday, another U.S. soldier died in a traffic accident near Balad, and this brings the total of U.S. troop deaths to 547 since the start of the war on March 20th. Now, I'd also like to talk about what the selection versus the election process, how that's going, and what the latest developments are. The U.S. has largely abandoned the idea of holding caucuses in Iraq, but that doesn't mean that elections are on the horizon. They're still looking at a June 30th turnover date. Paul Bremer has said that they're going to stick by that June 30th date to hand over power to an Iraqi government, regardless of what happens. So that means there are now two possibilities. They're looking at either expanding the governing council to 50 or as many as 125 people, or they're looking at selecting a body similar to the Loya Jirga in Afghanistan to run things. Now, either way, this is still going to be a selection process. It's still going to be the U.S. in partnership with these returning exile groups deciding on who's going to run Iraq for some 6 to 9 months until elections can be held. And the question is whether the Iraqi people will accept this or not. I think the answer is pretty clear on that score. Now, the governing council, as we know, has been really ineffective. It's been corrupt and fractured by infighting. Right now, the governing council is debating on whether or not to base the new Iraqi constitution on the Islamic Sharia law. I think that's highly ironic that what the U.S. is afraid of, Islamic fundamentalists coming to power through the election process, is actually occurring now in the governing council, which is made up of people that the U.S. government has largely selected to run Iraq. Meanwhile, this week, the Wall Street Journal reported that local elections have been taking place in about 9 or 10 municipalities in the southern Shiite region. And the outcome has surprised U.S. officials, who have expected, as I said, fundamentalist Islamic candidates to win most of these races. Instead, the Iraqi people have voted overwhelmingly for young, secular candidates. One U.S. official said, quote, "Voters want knowledgeable people who can give them services," end quote. Makes sense, right?
That's what we want here.
That's right. It's also an indication of what the Iraqi people have been getting via the governing council and the U.S. military authorities, people who don't know what's going on in Iraq and can't provide any services. Now, the Wall Street Journal used as an example the town of Nasiriyah, where U.S. officials did what Paul Bremer has been saying vehemently that the U.S. will not do. In the absence of a census, they relied on the U.N. Oil for Food Program database. Now, they had a 30% voter turnout, which is better than a lot of elections here in the U.S., and the Iraqi people elected a doctor, 3 school teachers, and 6 businessmen to run the Nasiriyah Town Council. None of these winning candidates were Islamic fundamentalists. Now, that gives you some idea of what would happen if there were a general election in Iraq. Right now, the U.S. has put together a governing council that contains extremely backward elements, returning exiles, and in the case of several members of the council, fundamentalist clerics. Now, I think the Iraqi people, at least the Shiites, have demonstrated that they're not willing to be ruled by Islamic clerics, and I think that the U.S. needs to actually let the election process happen. Now, were you going to say something, Mike?
No. I was going to ask you how our friend Halliburton was doing, but do you
Oh, yes, yes, yes. There is a little new development in the widening Halliburton scandal. Halliburton has agreed to temporarily stop billing the Pentagon for some $140 million in meals served to U.S. troops in Iraq and Kuwait. This is because Pentagon auditors are investigating charges that Halliburton has billed for thousands of meals that it never served in the 58 dining facilities that it manages in Iraq and Kuwait. Halliburton, I should point out, is the largest contractor to the U.S. military. They have an open-ended contract to provide services like laundry facilities, meals, etc., to U.S. troops based in Iraq, but also based in elsewhere around the world, including Kosovo, where Halliburton was also accused of overcharging for things like providing doors to offices for $1,500 doors for offices and charging for offices to be cleaned several times a day. That's the nature of the Pentagon auditors' investigation currently going on in Iraq. They're looking for things like that Halliburton is notorious for doing, and again, they're doing it again now. Now, I should also mention that the U.S. military contracts that Halliburton has are worth some $15 billion. That's how much money they're making off these deals. And I should also point out that the Vice President Dick Cheney was CEO of Halliburton through the year 2000 when he decided to quit that job and join the Bush administration as Vice President.
All right. I also saw very briefly that Japan this week went on to high alert in their country because they are now stationing troops in Iraq, about 300 troops in a southern city. which I just thought was interesting.
Yeah, yeah, and they're worried now about terrorist attacks.
And I think this is the first time they've really put
It's the first time they've put troops abroad that were for not for a specific peacekeeping mission that was sponsored by the UN. They had an enormous debate over sending troops abroad in the first place for UN peacekeeping missions. I believe their first mission was sending troops to Cambodia under a UN mandate to help with elections there. And this was enormously unpopular, sending troops to help with the U.S. mission, particularly since it is not under the UN, not under a UN mandate. And it has been enormously unpopular. There are opposition politicians in the Japanese parliament who have called for Koizumi's, the Japanese president's, ouster over this.
All right, and finally, briefly, Haiti, if you could touch on that.
Haiti, yes, it's amazing how it hasn't been covered much by the U.S. media. And what has been covered is just how terrible Jean-Bertrand Aristide is, the current president of Haiti, and in what terrible shape Haiti is in. I should note that Aristide, who was first elected in 1990 and then deposed in a military coup just a few months after his first election, he was then reinstated in 1994 with the help of the U.S., the Clinton administration at that time, helped to reinstate him as the president of Haiti. Elections were held in 1995, since the elections have to be held every 5 years in Haiti rather than every 2 to 4 years, like here in the United States. He was not allowed to stand for re-election in 1995, and it was a man named Préval who had links to the former military dictatorship who won the 1995 elections. Of course, nobody mentions how things deteriorated under Préval. And when 2000 rolled around and Aristide campaigned for re-election and it looked like he was going to win, the opposition party pulled out of the elections and refused to participate. They boycotted the polls and then went on an enormous campaign with the international community to get Aristide and his Lavalas party to get the international community to condemn the elections as not being fair because the opposition had largely boycotted the election. Now, what happened, the result of all that, was that international donor countries froze their aid money to Haiti. And in particular, the United States had a $500 million loan that it was going to give to Haiti. And when the Bush administration came into power, it was much more willing to sit down and listen to the opposition, which in Haiti is composed mostly of wealthy elites, former military members, and former members of the Tonton Macoute, the terrible paramilitary death squads that pretty much ran the country and terrorized the people under the Duvalier regime, the former Duvalier dictatorship. The Bush administration sat down with those people and said, okay, we're going to freeze that $500 million loan to Aristide since we do think he is a commie, so we're not going to fund him. Now, the current opposition includes not just those folks, it also includes some very, very poor people who have become disaffected under Aristide, and it's largely because his government is being choked, has no money in order to fund some of the promises that he made to increase health care, to provide clean drinking water to the some 60% of Haiti's people who don't have access to clean drinking water. And it's a scandal and a shock, and human rights groups have been condemning the fact that the Bush administration will not release these loans to Haiti, even though last July the Haitian government paid some $32 million in debt repayments to release those loans. Those loans have still been frozen. It is a scandal.
I believe it's the poorest country in the hemisphere.
It is,
Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time, talking once again with Maria Tomchik, co-editor at Eat the State. And Maria, tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places where you find free publications around town. We can be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word. If you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, you want to donate, you can give us a call at 206-903-9461. And we do need to help. We do need money to help pay our printing bill, since our printing bill is still a little too large for us. So if you want to donate, please give us a call. Check out our website, which has information on our address where you can send us a check.